भगवतो अर्हतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अर्हतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। So, today is the eight, sometimes called the eight lucky signs, sometimes called the eight auspicious symbols, which are these. I'm not entirely sure where this information that I'm giving you came from. It could very well have come from here. However, I have, on searching, not found it to contradict any other information about these symbols. And I have found this a very useful way to work. So if you will trust me to, maybe this is not altogether what these symbols mean to everybody, but that this might be a useful way for you to consider them. Is that okay? Then on that basis, I'll be glad to just go blah, blah, blah about the auspicious signs. In my understanding, the eight signs represent the Eightfold Path. And the first sign, and the first part of the Eightfold Path, is the banner of victory. It is the victory over all ignorance. What is the first step of the Eightfold Path? Right view. Right view, isn't it? Right view, first one. And victory over all ignorance is right view. Which one is the banner of victory? Here. Where's the umbrella? The top, isn't it? And that's an umbrella. And that's a banner of victory. You can tell because the banner of victory has these skirts. Sometimes they look exactly the same, except the banner of victory has this narrow kind of skirts things, almost like those wind...
wind socks.
Yeah, not called wind socks, though. The ones that they're sort of like these kind of flags that people put in their gardens, so you find them a lot in the east around temples and things. Forgotten the name for it, sorry. Almost like them, you know, the round.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what the banner of victory is. It proclaims the victory of vijja, or knowing, over ignorance. And what is the vijja as opposed to avijja? When someone asked the Buddha what it was like to be enlightened, he said, when I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep. Now that's good, isn't it? There are some days where I could almost say that. Oh, I think I'll just stay in bed for another half hour. Is it because I'm tired? I think so. And some of us sleep really well with our eyes open. And some of us can refuse to eat, no matter how nourishing the food may be. Is it true? All kinds of nourishment right there, as you were saying. So the first banner of victory represents right view. The classical description of what constitutes right view is seeing the Four Noble Truths. Knowing what is suffering, knowing the nature of dissatisfactoriness, knowing the cause of dissatisfactoriness, which is the paticca sampada, which we talked about last night, remember? You do remember that.
Goody!
Knowing that there is cessation of suffering, you know that, don't you? You know that if you just look at the dissatisfactoriness and stay present with it without like or dislike, without trying to get rid of it or trying to be attached to it, it passes. Do you know that? Because it's conditioned. Everything that is conditioned, the conditions cannot stay the same, so it's impermanent. Because there are discrete moments, not a fixed identity. So there is suffering. It is causal. The cause is interpenetrative, conditions that work together. There is an end to suffering. And there are particular ways that you can hold your mind and practice with body, speech, and mind that lead to cessation of being subject to suffering. That's the fourth noble truth, the path. That there, the fourth noble truth is there's something you can do. Which is really good news. There is suffering. There is cause. There is cessation. And there's something you can do. That's the Four Noble Truths. And that's what the banner of victory means. It means you have won. You are no longer subject. You see, oh, this is suffering. Oh, this is its cause. Oh, this is how it ends. Oh, there is something that can be done. That's victory, isn't it? Isn't it?
Well, if you practice it.
Well, as soon as you see it. As soon as you identify, oh, this is suffering, you don't say, oh, I don't like it, therefore I'm going to get rid of it. But you allow it to be, you look directly at it, you say, oh, this is suffering. Oh, it has cause. That's exactly it, if you allow it. That's what you said, wasn't it? If you allow it.
Well, I can understand a lot of things, but then to do my part in to make it whole, it just seems like do it, you know, like.
Sometimes you do, and sometimes you don't you? Sometimes you do it.
I know it's so easy, but it's just sometimes it just doesn't seem to.
It doesn't work.
You can slip. I mean, yeah, let it slip by, mm-hmm. And then...
That's right. And then you say, oh, gee, I let that slip by. You understand? It's not a matter of perfection, Otto.
I'm still sweating.
You don't have to. It's not a matter of perfection. It's, in Buddhism, do as much as you are able.
So just keep putting your nose
in. As much as you are able. When you can see something is suffering, identify it like that. Don't start pushing it, trying to change it, making it different. Oh, this is dissatisfactory. There is a sense of unease here. Oh, this is dissatisfactory. What is the cause? Oh, it comes and goes. It isn't constant. Oh, here's a cessation. Oh, I can do something about it. So it's not a matter of doing it perfectly. It's a matter of when you can see it to work with it. And you're right. When you can do it, it's fine, but you don't always see it. That's right. The thing is, to see it at all is an improvement. Because until you see it, until you see those four factors, you just feel like everything is a trick or there's no way out, you know, you feel totally trapped. You feel like everything's going on and you don't understand it, you don't know what to do, you're always trying to make people like you or whatever, right? You're always like two steps behind where everything is going. Because you're, right?
Yeah.
Whereas when you begin to see this, you realize it's not something that you're going to do, it's something you're going to see. You don't actually have to change, really, unless you're doing really unwholesome things. You don't actually have to change any of your actions. You just have to change your perception. And mostly our perception, when there's something we don't like, is we just don't see it. We just change our view, don't we? We just adjust the set. Oh, tune out the greens here. Oh, turn up the sharp here. Oh, like contrast down here. Okay. We got our little remotes going. We're remoting like that. And so the first one in some ways is the hardest, to allow yourself to feel the dissatisfactory without judgment. Without judgment. Just feel it without judgment. Don't try to change it.
But isn't there things that you should change?
Murder. Like taking what isn't freely given. Improper use of sensuality. Major intoxication. Using speech in harmful ways.
What if they're another?
You're not in other people.
So that means you should just ignore it then?
Oh no, you should use them as a way for you to explore dislike in yourself.
But how? So you shouldn't.
So somebody does something you don't like, right? Like, right?
Right, okay.
Give me an example.
We'll say somebody says something about somebody else that you don't like.
That you don't like. What did they say?
Well, they say somebody is an idiot. Somebody insults somebody else. No, you just
and you feel that, and you look at the person, right?
And you want to respond to that and say, "No, this person isn't as bad as you say they are, or whatever."
Or, but is that going to work? Is that going to help them?
No, it helps yourself.
Yeah. So what you want to do is not make yourself feel better. You want to notice that that person is obviously suffering.
So how can you help them?
Well, that's the real question, you see, at that point. And you say, oh yeah, what kind of idiot? You have choices. If you don't just automatically let your dislike push you into ping pong, you have some options. Or what makes them an idiot? Or you can say, boy, I really react to you saying that. You could try just blatant out-and-out honesty. You could give them that gift of yourself. You know, I don't like calling people idiot. You could just give them that, couldn't you?
Sure, yeah. That's another way to
go. And what would happen? You know, so there are lots of choices.
Probably won't change their view anyway.
You don't know, but if you change your view of dislike, dislike basically tries to get rid of something. You want them to not say that. So what's the difference between that and a mass murderer? Degree. Move your head a little that way, Terry. No, not you. Thank you. Do you understand that? It's the degree. Thank you. Dislike is, I don't want that to exist. Why? Because it disturbs me.
But should it disturb us then?
I don't know. If it is, disturbing you, it does disturb you. Whether it should or not is not the issue. But what should you do with that disturbance? The Four Noble Truths says, First of all, notice that there is a disturbance. Oh, there is dissatisfactoriness. Okay, and there is a cause for it. What is the cause? Should it cause you to want to stop the world out there? There's going to be somebody else. You get rid of him, there's going to be somebody right behind him, isn't it? And here you got the Buddha talking to the shoemaker, and he's saying the shoemaker is angry about everything pretty well. And he says to the shoemaker, which is easier, to cover the world with leather or to wear shoes? Because you get rid of that one, and another one's going to come up, right? It's always somewhere. So you can go out there and try to get rid of all the sources of dissatisfaction. Or you can begin to explore the dissatisfaction that's arising in here. Because it's arising in here. Isn't it? Am I wrong? Are you the one who feels dissatisfied with what he's saying?
Of course, yeah.
Oh, so it's arising in you. You don't know whether he is or not, but you do know that you are. Right? So you're the one who needs the medicine, not him.
But he does need medicine. It's, I know. Medicine.
So cover the world with leather. You know, you can do that. You can, and sometime or other, you'll get tired of it. But it's nice to know that for you. That seems like a viable alternative. Get it out there to straighten up. So that's the way you're going to approach suffering. Then you do that, but be conscious that you're trying to make it line up out there. And so when it doesn't work, or if you find yourself every once in a while exploding with rage a bit, do you?
Yeah.
Exploding with rage a bit, you might think to yourself, this is because I'm trying to do something that's too hard to do. Unless you have the sense that if you could just impose your will enough on other people, they would suddenly become the kind of people you want them to be. You know? Do you understand me? It's very hard to work that way. The only way you can get everybody else to agree with you is through, as a dictator, through fear. You got two choices. You can be such a dictator that everybody is terrified when you're in the room. Or you can practice love no matter what people do. You got those two choices, basically. And why you would choose either one of them is the same root. The root is the sense of dissatisfaction, right? The unsettledness when someone says something you don't like. Right? So, Buddhism says, in the long run, it's a lot less painful, a lot more joy in your life if you just start working directly with the dislike. In the long run, it's easier to wear shoes than to cover the world with leather. There is a certain kind of surge of righteousness, pride, and power that comes with the anger, isn't there? Don't you think so?
No, definitely.
Well, geez, you sure hate to admit these things, don't you? I mean, everybody in this room knows that. Don't you all know that? Any of you here do not know that? That righteousness you feel? You can all identify it, can you?
Yes.
So you're not alone.
No, good goodness.
But, and so, like, there is that. The problem is that the high does not last very long. And then when you come down from it, and you got all those corpses around you, you know? That you walk into a room and people go, right? The downside of it is the result and the guilt you have to live with for a while. And then you start again, slowly building up, and then pretty soon, right? So you bend over backward a bit, and you be really nice, and you, you know, prove to everybody what a nice guy you are, right? And then something dissatisfies you, but you bury it because you can tolerate it. And then a few more, and then another one, and then boom again, and then the whole circle, right? Does it go in a cycle? Yeah. Is it fun? Well, you've never thought about it. Well, why not? It's your life energy. It's your pattern. You have two choices. You can practice being aware of what is present and seeing how to allow yourself to be present, or you can try to change what is present. Trying to change what is present doesn't have a hope in heaven, hell, or earth of working. You can make a temporary, adjustment. But actually changing your perception of what to do if you dislike something, you have every hope. It's very easy to do. Have I answered your question?
Yes.
Okay. So, Four Noble Truths? Get used to it. I love it. First noble truth. Hey, you're right. There is dissatisfactoriness. Yes. B, it's not personal. It has cause. It has cessation. It's not personal. That's a paticca samuppada. There is no identity. There is no fixed self. That's a paticca samuppada. Beautiful teaching. It's impermanent. Whatever is caused, dependent on conditions, cannot exist because conditions do not stay the same. Right? Remember the poem about the one horse shade? The 100-year, what was it called? The 100-year, what was it? The ballad of the 100-year shay or something? This carpenter who built this two-wheeler shay. You know what a shay was? It was a carriage. Wasn't it a two-wheel carriage that had the little hood, and the harness? And he was really tired of his shay always breaking down. So he built this one that every piece was done as perfectly as every other piece. And nothing ever happened to it. And they took it out of the carriage house regularly, rode it down the street on Sunday, regularly, just clipped along. It was absolutely beautiful. And then exactly at 100 years, the whole thing all together disintegrated in one boom. No warning. Just 1 minute it was there, poof. Lovely poem. What was that, grade 7, grade 6, yeah. Something like that. I know why, because it's before your time. That's right. Only some of us remember. Those of us who were educated in Alberta or Saskatchewan around the time of the Second World War, we remember. So if something is based on conditions, the conditions do not stay the same. Everything is moving. Everything is in flux. And so it cannot last. And there is something you can do. So that's the first noble truth. And every time you are aware of, this is dissatisfactoriness, the banner of victory is already flying. Already you are victorious over being ignorant. You're not trying to make yourself bigger than the world. You're not just disliking something because it exists. Already the banner of victory is flying. So that's the first one. Even just the smallest awareness. the banner of victory is flying. And the second stage of the path, which is right, which is what? Right view. Right thought. Is the umbrella. The umbrella, which is the shade against the glaring heat and unseemly weather of conflicting emotion. Non-lust, non-ill will, and non-harm, not wishing to harm, no motive to harm, no motive to get rid of, no motive. That's the umbrella. It protects you from the heat of unwholesome emotionality. I just don't know what got into me. The other thing about the umbrella is, if you have that kind of evenness of the calm, that evenness of kindness toward all beings, immediately you are connected with everyone around you. They care for you, don't they? You know, the umbrella is also the umbrella of a community. How a community works together is an umbrella. It's also the umbrella of consciousness that blesses an area. By practicing non-lust, non-ill will, and non-harm, the entire area is blessed. The animals, the plants, everything about it, the energy moves better in that area. So everything it become is more harmonious, more good happens for everyone. So it's also the umbrella. It's the energy under which everything is protected. The other thing is that the folds, you know, the ribs represent like, you know, the ribs of an umbrella are very fine but very strong. How powerful is that support of non-harm, of non-lust, of non-ill will? How powerful is that support, and how the folds of energy, how that support allows the shadings of compassion to fall on everyone, even those who are not holding the umbrella. It benefits everyone. It's a very big umbrella. And how is that umbrella possible? It is only possible to have that experience of non-harm, of non-lust, and of non-ill will if you don't feel like you are God. if you don't feel like you are the one who is responsible for everything, if you feel that you're the one who's in control and who's responsible for everything, can you be even-tempered? Why? Why, Claire? What happens?
You're in control, and the energy doesn't flow then.
And somebody else comes along and does something that doesn't follow what your control says should happen.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody dares to be non-you, and you're in control. And what happens?
Frustration, anger.
Yeah. Or somebody smiles at you, right? And you think, oh, well, they should belong to me. Right? You're screwing up my plans. Right? So when the emotions are all involved about I see how this should be. When the emotions are all trying to protect the position of I, then it's not possible to have that protection from the conflicting, from the conflict. It's only when the emotions are not centered around I, that is, when you're interested in non-harm, which means you think the other person or the other event or what else is happening has as much right, power, causation, energy, interest, livingness as you do, rightness as you do. Does that make sense to you? Questions? No. Okay. And then what's the next one? You don't know the Eightfold Path, huh? Much fine Buddhist you are.
I said in order, though. Right understanding?
Right view, right thought, right speech. Yeah. Right view, we've done. What's right view?
Four noble.
Truth. And what symbol is it?
Banner.
And what's the second noble truth? Second of the Eightfold Path? Huh?
Right view.
What's the first one?
Right view.
What's the second one?
Right there.
Right thought.
Right thought, yeah.
I'm not using the word understanding here.
Okay.
You're comparing something you've read to what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So go read your book.
Yeah.
Right thought. What's the third one? Right speech. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action. Right view is to be able to view things properly, not have your preconceived view. Be able to see things as they are. And that is the Four Noble Truths. Right thought, how you're going to work with that, is emotional. Okay, how are you going to work with it? Non-hate, non-lust, non-harm. Right speech, there are four qualities. Oh, right speech is the endless knot, which is a net, isn't it? The net of activity, the whole mode of body, all of the flows of energy. That's what speech is, an energy. All the flows of energy. You should remember this one. What do you know about right speech? Nothing?
Was
harsh words or something.
Right?
Awesome.
Yeah.
What?
Idle talk or something like that.
Yeah. Dad language. Yeah. Dad language. Right?
Division.
Yeah. Remember, you're starting to remember this, eh?
Speaking bad about someone.
First one is out and out lying,
yeah.
Right? Isn't it? Second one is demonizing, right? Third one is splitting with speech, creating division, hatchet. And fourth one is dead. Using speech to deaden, to blanket, to keep things down. Do you remember that? 10 marks of Sila? Remember? Xerox Queen of Calgary brought those papers up once. Do you remember that? Some of you remember that. Remember the Xerox Queen of Calgary? Do you remember her?
Yeah.
What was your name?
Cecily.
Cecily Kaya, that's right. And she always brings paper up here, remember that? Lots of it. I think she has shares in Xerox, right? And she has this writing on these pages, right? One time she had one that the front page said 10 marks of Sila, right? And four of them were speech, remember that? And the first one of the speech was what?
Lying.
And often in the Tibetan, where's the knot? Here. Often in Tibetan, this is a sign for love. You know, love? Mm-hmm. You know? Often. Why? Because non-lying, honesty, is what you do if you're a lover. You're after intimacy. Aren't you? Huh? If someone you absolutely love says you're an idiot, it doesn't feel the same way, does it? Does it?
Shouldn't have said that.
But I'm asking you.
No, of course
not. And why not?
It doesn't disturb you.
Because everything they do is interesting to you. Because you love them. Because you're open to them. If someone you love has a really funny right ear, there's nothing you like more than tucking their hair back and tracing it. You say you have the cutest, funniest right ear, especially when you first meet them, right? And you love to stroke it, right? And then when, you know, the rose color starts to fade, you know, go a little brown, you say, why don't you wear your hair over your head? But it's only when you are not in a state of love that you want, you're interested in non-truth. You're interested in hiding. You know? You only lie if you're not a lover. Change things, leave something out. Huh? If you're a lover, how things manifest is endlessly fascinating. Isn't it true? So this sign is used often to represent love. Because lovers use speech for union. And it's called the secret spirit of all victory. Speech. Because it's the energy, the motive, the vibration that makes the word that draws us together. that joins the known to the unknown. Speech. Now, Meister Eckhart, that beautiful quote of Meister Eckhart, God has left a small point twixt thee and he. You know, there is the unknown that you want to reach, and there is the known, and what gets you toward it is the energy, the attraction, the speech. Right? This, in its earliest form, was this symbol was the two rivers, or the two snakes, actually. Representing, you know, the right and left channel, or knowing and being, or the opposites. The opposites and how, where they, when opposites meet, right at that point where they meet is the central channel. That's what the central channel is the balance point between opposites. And it's if you can be opposite and refuse to meet, or you can be opposites and feel the energy of that oppositeness and make it interesting, and then there is a point right in between the two where the energy transcends both. Where meeting the unknown gives one a doorway into transcendence. You can either dislike what is not you, or you can fall in love with the transcendent opportunity. So that's what also the two snakes, like the two energies weaving, right? Like the, what's that sign they used to have on drugstores? What's it called? The Caduceus? Mm-hmm. It's the same symbol. Two snakes, right? And the central, the staff. It's the side channel is in the central channel. And love is healing, isn't it? So it's also all of the kundalini and all of the, you know, tai chi and all of the yoga, that's all speech, used properly speech. Getting your body attuned to the great words. And it also talks about the interdependence. The way that reality exists is through interdependence. Is that good? Is this interesting to you?
Mm-hmm.
You seem a bit bored with me.
No.
Maybe it's because it's the third day you've been listening to me for 3 days. Are you going back to Calgary soon? I had enough of you. Yeah, it's warm in here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably it. Couldn't be bored. So, you know, traditionally the four things are non-lying, non-tale-bearing or gossip, which I was calling creating divisiveness, right? Non-tale-bearing. Demonizing. Demonizing. Non-harsh speech, which is hatchet jobbing, and non-dead speech. So that's a pretty good trick if you can do that with your speech, isn't it?
What's the clarify the dead speech or the flattening?
Dead speech.
Yeah, dead speech. Is it idle chatter or?
Sometimes, or if somebody says something interesting, you just turn it into small talk, or you say, oh yeah, my cousin did that once and he died. You know? You know the kind of thing.
Like verbal abuse would be unnecessary.
Verbal abuse, it would be hatchet, harsh. Dead is much more passive. It's like somebody comes out of a lecture, and as they're coming out of the lecture, somebody around immediately says, oh, we have a meeting we got to go to next week, don't forget, and by the way, you know? Just jumps on them and starts like, they don't give them time to absorb whatever it was they were just doing. It's like a vulture kind of thing, you know? Keeping everything down, kill the yeast. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Would this apply also to one's thinking processes as well as the verbal?
Any speech, any energy communication.
So
it's a big thing. Speech is big.
Yeah.
So even that little voice that talks, you know, you're talking to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, you can certainly watch that, but in particular, watch it with others. That's where, you know. So the next one is, you don't know the Eightfold Path. I can't believe it. You don't know the Eightfold Path, Kathy? Say it out loud.
No.
I don't know the Eightfold Path.
I don't know the Eightfold Path.
Oh, God.
I know about it, though.
Oh.
Great conjugation.
Great action. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action. And right action is the boss. Where's the boss? Is that it?
Must be, yeah.
Yeah. The realm of desire, right? There are three realms, right? In Buddhism, there are three realms that the universe is made of, three different realms. One is Kamaloka, right? The realm of desire, which includes human, animal, all the hell realms, all the hungry ghost realms. And four of the ten angelic realms. You all knew that, didn't you? What's the next realm? That's called Kama Loka. And then the next realm is called Rupa Loka, which means the form realm. No, human is part of sensual realm. Is... use the word manifestation, which I did, so I guess you can. Okay?
The last one for the tape.
And the third realm is called Arupa Loka, which is all the formless realms, the great God realms. Yeah. So there are these three realms. Have you heard this before? The sensual realm, all the beings born in the sensual realm have six sense doors. Is anything familiar yet? They have six sense doors, right? Which are? Sight?
The five senses in the mind.
Five senses in the mind. Right? And the beings who live in the fine material plane, the Rupa Loka, have how many sense doors? Three sense doors, which are? Sight, sound, and mind. And then the beings in the fine material realm, And in the non-material realm, the have how many sense doors?
One.
Which is?
Mind.
Mind, right. So you are remembering this now a little bit, right? So in the Buddhist cosmology, there are three main categories of manifestation. Okay? Three, the universe is composed of three main types of beings. Hell realms, hungry ghost realms, animal realms, human realms, and some of the angelic realms are all six sense doors. Of all of those realms, the human realm is particularly beneficial to be born into because there's enough of a balance between dissatisfactoriness and bliss so that you can feel enough bliss to experience some calm and you can feel enough dissatisfactoriness to wonder why you don't feel the calm all the time. You got enough suffering to ask a good question and enough calm to get a good answer. Is that clear?
Yes.
And so the human realm is considered to be a very excellent birth. The three sense door realm can be a good birth, but not necessarily and probably not. Why?
Too much bliss?
It's very nice. There's no impetus. And the non-material realms are also considered to be even more likely to when the conditions that support a birth into that realm end, to not have developed anything from that birth, to do anything except get angry. What? This is ending? Hayungamunga! And down you go. Okay? So each of these realms are all three of these. Where is that vase? Here it is. You notice the thing about the vase that they show we know what this is? This is the jewel that is in the center of the vase. The vase is usually quite crude, and the jewel is the wish-fulfilling jewel. The jewel of great price. The vase is crude because it's not permanent. It changes according to conditions. The jewel is unendingly beautiful, unchanging. The jewel is consciousness, clarity. The jewel is bodhicitta. The jewel is that in you, that in all consciousness, which knows. Right? And the form changes. In order to discover the jewel, it must be in a form. In order to awaken, there needs to be a you and a me. Does this make sense to you?
No.
There has to be a you. If you are going to awaken, there has to be a you.
Yes.
Who, to have that aspiration.
Yes.
So, the vase here, representing right action, represents the activity of the entire manifestation of the entire multiverse. That was something that Namgyal Rinpoche, my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche, said one day. Universe, and then he said, well, no, not universe, multiverse. That was very good. So the vase represents all of the form, all of the drive of cause and effect, of mind and body, in all possible manifestation. That's the vase with the jewel inside of it, right? The rim of the vase, what is coming over the rim, what is already manifesting and moving out of manifestation, right? The karma that is manifesting, the form realm, is the desire realm. What's flooding over the rim, what's coming into manifestation, is the desire realm, is the human realm, right? The sixth sense door realm. Is that clear? That's what it represents. The realm of desire is represented by the rim, the realm of form by the belly of the vase, and all the markings on the outside of the vase, all the design, all the swirls and ripples, right? And the formless realm by the empty space. Which a vase contains as well. It's very beautiful. Also, the decorations on the vase correspond to look this way, it's samsara, look this way, it's nirvana. The non-separateness of samsara and nirvana. All of the patterning, all of the movement. Perceived one way, it's suffering. Perceived another way, it's peace. So, right action is the harmony of spiritual and material aims. Very beautiful. Acting in harmony. Right action in harmony means panatipata. I undertake to train myself to refrain from killing and harming, because that is not acting in harmony.
Killing and what?
Harming.
Harming. Harming.
Panatipata. Adina Dana, I undertake to train myself to refrain from taking that which is not freely given, because that would not be acting in harmony. Kamesu Michachara, I undertake to train myself to refrain from swooning, indulging, blanking out in pleasure, in indulgence. So all of these point to the same thing, in not thinking that the inner desire is more valuable than the outer desire. To be in harmony. When His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, all beings desire pleasure, that's right action. Like all beings, I desire pleasure. Like myself, all beings desire pleasure. Everyone's life is as valuable to them as mine is to me. So I am disturbed by this, and there are probably things that that person is disturbed by. I feel joy from this, and there are probably things that person feels joy from. That's right action. It makes sense, too. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Basic respect. What was that? R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Oh, sorry. And so with right action, then the next one is, I'm going to give up asking you anymore, is right lively. Oh, yes! Yes! Wonderful. I love it when you surprise me. Right livelihood, which is right down here, the wheel. Right livelihood is what the Paticca-samuppada ends up being. Knowing how every cause is moving. Right livelihood is a boundless experience. Because that's what the Paticca-samuppada is, isn't it? Right livelihood, I think, could be summarized in that saying that used to be around 20, 30 years ago, the gift is always giving. Do you remember that? Remember that saying? Very beautiful, isn't it? The gift must always move. That's another way I've heard it. Or the Tibetan saying, when you make an offering, the giver, the gift, and the recipient become one. Right livelihood is recognizing that recycling is all we do. That landfill is just the other side of mining. You take it out of the earth, you pass it through this donut of the intestines, right? It goes through the donut, it does a little transformation, it comes out the other end, and it goes back into the earth, right? And this donut is doing the same. You're a donut, you recognize that, don't you? Some yogis put the cloth all the way through. That's what it is. It's a wheel. Where's the beginning and end of a wheel? Where is it? That's right livelihood. It's when you realize that everything that nourishes you is going through the chain. You know, it's like you're just a link. You are a link. The gift must always move. There's no separate. That's an interesting one. And that's what the Paticca-samuppada is. If there is no inherent self, which is what that insight is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Am I interfering with your thought process? Mm-hmm. Oh. What do you think? Is that what the Paticca-samuppada is? Then if that is what the Paticca-samuppada is doing, is letting go of the sense of an I or a self, an inherent self, if it is the insight that creates the middle way, because it is seeing that causality is a bunch of discrete moments, but no inherent self, then livelihood is no longer what should I do, but how are we in this chaining energy together? Isn't it? All parts of the whole. And the whole is continuously changed because of the parts. And the parts continuously change because of the whole. So not one directional cause and effect, but continuously molding and shaping back and forth between the cause and the effect and the cause and the effect. The cause becomes the effect, becomes the cause, becomes the effect. right livelihood is living with that knowledge, where your livingness is interwoven with the awareness of the boundlessness, not of the boundary. Right livelihood is where your livingness is involved with the boundlessness, not with the boundary. And that's the turning of the wheel. And that's what the Buddha did on his vision. Light arose in him. How far? As far as cause and effect was turning. That's how large the sense of self became or dissolved. All cause and effect dancing, wheels within wheels within wheels, Ezekiel. And generally speaking, the way to understand right livelihood is by practicing loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it works.
Yeah.
Not what I am going to do, but how to weave kindliness, how to extend the weave of kindliness, how my touch, my reach can extend your touch, can extend your reach, can extend her touch, you know? How there can be no separation without losing the power to discriminate. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's right livelihood. So after right livelihood comes right effort, which is right there. The lotus. This is so you know what right effort is. You should know right effort. Do you know right effort? Develop the wholesome.
We're there for effort. Drop the wholesome, drop the wholesome, encourage or develop the. Right?
Develop the wholesome, got one. Yeah. Drop the unwholesome, got two.
Develop the wholesome.
Yeah.
And then develop it or encourage it.
Encourage is pretty close. Name it.
Name it.
Make it conscious.
Yeah.
Choose to name it. Discriminate. This is wholesome. Hmm. That makes power, doesn't it? Mindfulness is power. Drop when you notice that you're doing something unwholesome. What?
Drop.
Drop it. Next one. Namgyal Rinpoche's description. If you're an alcoholic, don't go into a bar for a drink of water.
Yeah.
What is that? Where you see the possibility of unwholesome, don't go there. Right effort. Lotus. A lotus starts in the mud. Puts his little tendrils down and says, oh, this is mud. Feels some energy, says, oh, there's light somewhere. There's all these different movements and possibilities, all this water, right? Current here, moves you here. Current there, moves you there. You keep getting swayed back and forth. The light is still pulling you up. And how do you keep on course with all the swaying energies of all of the currents? How do you do that? The four efforts. Oh, I'm going too far this way. Too much unwholesome. I'm losing the light here. I better get back over this way a little more. Oh, I'm losing the light there. I better come over this way a little more. Because your stem is flexible. You're not as inflexible as you like to pretend. And then the trick is to actually be above the surface of the water. Because this lotus, part of the myth of it, you see how it's above its base? The part of the myth of it, it goes up to a foot above the surface of the water before it opens. And so underneath the water, it's very flexible, but when it's up there, it holds itself up. So it is, although it grows from the mud, and it moves through very, you've seen lotus ponds, haven't you? They're pretty murky, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And what about a lotus flower when it opens? Is it murky?
No.
Is it muddy?
No.
Does it have a perfume? Yeah. Does it smell like the swamp it grows in?
No.
Isn't that a beautiful analogy? Mm-hmm. Through the mud, nourished by that, moving toward that. Right effort. And the analogy says that the lotus in its growth protects its companions in the swamp. The idea being that when you begin to see how in one lotus starting to move up encourages others to do the same, not to get caught. And when the lotus is a foot above the water and opens, then all the bees are attracted. And bees are always a symbol of this energy opening here. Up here. They're always a symbol. In Egypt, that's what it used to be used for, the bee and honey and all that. And sometimes you feel a pressure like that. And sometimes you hear a buzzing. Some of the sadhanas talk about that, don't they? Like the sound of the drone of thousands of bees. It's the compassion of seeing. Right effort requires the compassion of seeing what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Not saying, me and you, haha, I'm glad you did that, uh-oh. Knowing that if the muddy water splashes, everybody gets dirty. So that's right effort. We're getting there, aren't we? Next one is right mindfulness, right awareness. It's right here. The conch shell. And again, this one comes from the ocean or comes from water. And again, out of the very milieu, which could be eating you or causing you damage, you create refuge. I love that one. Isn't that beautiful? That's what right mindfulness is. It's called the immaculate self-made object. Isn't that great? Right mindfulness. And you know what it is? It's so gorgeous. When it is five stages. The fifth stage apparently only a Buddha can do. Okay? First stage is when you see something you like, see if you can see something you dislike in it. No, isn't that a puzzle? Excuse me, I don't want to do that. Second stage, when you see something you dislike, see if you can see something you like in it. Third stage, when you see something you dislike in what you like, see if you can remember what you liked about it. You getting this? Fourth stage, when you can see something you like in what you previously disliked, see if you can remember what you disliked about it. You got this? You got this? Do you want me to do it again?
Yes, please.
First, when you see something you like, notice that you like it and find something that you could dislike in it. That's like if you're really attracted to someone and you find you're obsessed by them, imagine a booger hanging out of their nose. Because you know they have boogers. Right? So you say, well, they could have a booger hanging out of their nose sometime when I turn around and look at them. Right? So what does that do?
That's the obsession.
It balances mind, right? And so having done that, having imagined that, you know, the person has a booger, you'll find you're sort of half looking for the booger next time you meet them. Right? So then because you have done this with the mind, now you go back to, you're looking at the mind now. Now you imagine, yeah, but all of their boogers smell like violets. You understand? You don't let yourself stay there. Right? This, isn't this interesting? This is called right mindfulness. This is the classic definition of right mindfulness. When you see something you like, see something you dislike in it. When you see something you dislike, see something you like in it. When you can see something you dislike in what you previously liked, now look for liking it. When you see something you like in what you previously disliked, now look for disliking it. Those are the four. Those are pretty easy. They really are. In fact, it gets to be fun if you actually try it. It's fun. The fifth one, they say only a Buddha can be successful at, hold both the like and dislike equally in your mind. That's called right awareness. That's refuge. That gives the sound of victory over view and conflicting emotion. Clinging to view and emotions that create conflict. That's the sound of victory. That's the refuge in the water When you're caught in the ocean with predators around, that's the shell that creates refuge. And that is the sound of victory when you can do it. They're beautiful. I think these symbols are very beautiful, very clear. So that only leaves one symbol, right? Which is? Huh?
Fishes.
The fishies. And for this, we'll go into the backyard.
You got the lights on?
The two fish, right? These ones are actually originally, these two fish were the two rivers, the Ganges and the Yamuna River, the two sacred rivers of India, originally. And you understand how profound and powerful the rains and the rivers and the waters in India are. The source of renewal, right? And this is right concentration, the last of the Eightfold Path. And right concentration is you are part of the ocean and you are a fish. The fish is not separate from the ocean. It's the eyes of consciousness in the ocean. The eyes in the ocean of consciousness. Aware and awareness and totality together. No separateness. The two energies, awareness and totality. Right concentration. Yeah.
The second one, awareness and I didn't hear it.
Totality. Awareness tends to be I, doesn't it? Separateness. But here you have these two fish, awareness and totality. Together. Where duality is in union. In the ocean of consciousness. Right concentration. You don't miss a detail, and none of the details create duality. Now that wouldn't be a bad trick. So how's that? Those are the eight symbols. Okay. That's the Eightfold Path.
So why are they called the lucky symbols?
Because it's lucky. You are fortunate to hear it. It is considered that the greatest blessing you have, the greatest gift you have, the greatest good fortune you have is to be able to hear truth. Because once you know something, it cannot be taken from you. Your life can be taken from you, your happiness can be taken from you. But what you know to be true, if something is true, it cannot be taken from you. In the Chinese system, they say, if it moves, it is not the true heart. truth is unmoving. And that's the root of the word dharma.
Dharma
means unmoving, fixed, immutable. One of the immutable truths is change. I love that. I think that's gorgeous. So that's why they're lucky, because it's great luck to even hear these. To know that, you know, right effort or right action is, or right livelihood. Right livelihood is to practice livelihood in a boundless way. And one exercise one of my teachers once gave me to do, because I was really conscious of right livelihood at one point, he told me to imagine that someone I loved greatly and respected, or the Buddha, was standing beside me throughout the day. Well, that certainly changed some of my... because it put the boundary bigger than just me seeing. You understand? It maybe didn't make it boundless, but it moved the boundary up. And right livelihood has to do with boundless activity, with the gift, boundlessness, you know. The gift is always giving. There's no end to a gift. The giver, the gift, the recipient are one. Non-conditional.
That has its roots in a way of being on the planet. You know?
Exactly.
It's a endless gift.
Yeah, and it's an island.
Yeah.
And it's a wheel. Yeah. And the, or the planet being in the solar system. Because it's an endless gift. And it's an island. And it's a wheel. Or the solar system being in the Milky Way.
Quite expansive.
Yeah. Boundless. Is, that's what livelihood is, boundless. This chaos theory taken really far. Go beyond the butterfly and the pole.
The symbol for right livelihood and the symbol for right speech, both of them, like what the wheel, it's about what's eternal, or so is the symbol for...
The right speech is the, like the two snakes, yeah.
With the pattern there?
Yeah, the endless knot.
Yeah, well that... I think it's endless, right? And so is the
yeah.
The
boundless, yeah.
Yeah. That's it, I guess. I guess there's a question there. Or
is there?
Yeah.
Okay. What is it?
Well, I don't know.
Okay. I don't know what. Would you please answer me? Because I would like to know what my question is.
Thank you.
I told you I went to see my mama once, and she's looking everywhere in her apartment. And I said, "What are you looking for?" She said, "I can't remember." I said, "Oh, that's great. I'll help you." Neither one of us will know when we find it. We can look as long as we want. Some real benefits to old age. What are you looking for? I don't know. Oh, excellent. My kind of looking. I love that. I hate it when you're actually looking for something because you can't stop until you find it, you know? But if it really doesn't matter, hey, this has real virtue here. And that's one of the problems with boundlessness, isn't it? what's the point?
the pink base of each symbol.
That's like the lotus. Like this is the energy that this arises.
In all the symbols?
All the symbols. This is a lotus flower, stylized. In up there, you see that one, that color chakra? It is sitting on it. The symbol that is sitting on a lotus. You see green Tara? She's sitting on a lotus. You see over here, Vajradhara? He's sitting on a lotus. That means the lotus means the energy field. You know, the energy. On this energy field arises this vibration, which is supported and comes into being. There has to be a motive, there has to be an energy before there's a manifestation.
Are these symbols are not necessarily Tibetan, then?
No, they're not. They are actually very old. Some of them are predate, and some of them are like they vary. Like the unending knot, for example, and the fish. They go back 6,000-7,000 years, but I don't know. But they were adopted by the Tibetan, and they're adopted by Buddhism. To represent the Eightfold Path, as far as I'm concerned.
You said there must be a motive before there is.
I said there has to be energy.
Oh, there has to be.
There has to be some energy before there's anything that's going to arise. Yeah. That's what the lotus represents.
It occurs to me with right livelihood, given where this came from in a society where if you were a farmer or a shoemaker or whatever, you would kind of like that all the time. That's what you were. Whereas it's really easy today to, for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, I'm this. And then I get in my car and come home and I can pretend I'm something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to compartmentalize your
and
your
even because a lot of people morality. Don't live where they were born. Mm-hmm. Would you say that is
yes.
even more true
yes.
of what you're saying? Yeah, this is very true. Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Most people would consider right livelihood to mean I'm not being bad. Not to mean it's we are part of an endless flow. To me, right livelihood means don't shit in the river. You know? Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the old beginning where people are interpreting the jobs. Well, this is expanding into living. So,
but it's also how you're fed, how you interact,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
how your energy flow.
And how you're living.
How you're supported and how you support.
The initial trap I had when I first read that part of the Eightfold Path is the tendency, if you have a regular job that's an 8 hour a day, that the first thought livelihood triggers in my mind is, what do I do to make my daily bread? Rather than encompassing the entire 24 hours of existence and how I interact and, you know, and feed and nourish and be nourished from.
Yeah.
So it's easier to, for some people, I think,
to split
well,
off.
I'm a good person when I don't have to do what I have
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, yeah. And we all have areas where we think we're a good person. But we're not shitting in the river here, but we do have to shit and you're in the river there. You know? Yeah. is there a question particularly that you were?
No, I just.
Yeah, it's such
just
a beautiful.
Opened up a whole
that's beautiful.
Area to,
beautiful observation.
To really think about. Yeah. Can we make that distinction?
What
okay
distinction?
Shit in the river over there, but not over here.
But I'm saying we do make that distinction,
yeah,
don't we?
Is that the right thing to do then?
Then we think about it, don't we? Because one of the nice things about a human birth is there's enough dissatisfactoriness, enough niggle to make you ask a question. And there's enough calm getting away with it to get an answer. When you do it, just be aware of it. And keep the question live. Don't bury the question because it is dissatisfactory. And don't blame someone else. It's that every question you have, every time you're disturbed, it's a gift from a Buddhist point of view. Some of the gifts I really have a hard time unwrapping. I can struggle over them for months, and they're really simple to unwrap. I'm just having a problem. And then all of a sudden, I'll realize that I was trying to open it by removing the pattern on the wrapping paper instead of moving the tape. You know? And it goes, oh, right. Got it. It doesn't matter how long it takes. Only that you keep the question alive. That's all it matters. That you don't back away from it or let the question close everything down. That you honor the question. But in our society, we also try for answers, don't we? Because we don't like those questions, do we? Huh? Pat, 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 pat. Keep the ground nice and smooth. That bothered me. I'm not going there again. And it's wise to not go somewhere. Something that bothers you is a mirror. And if right livelihood is true, if there is any suffering, it's my suffering. Isn't it? If all of us are passing the gifts to each other, then none of us are separate. And I think that's what Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about in that poem, Please Call Me By All My Names. That very beautiful poem. We cannot hold ourselves separate from anyone else. Not if we wish to find peace with us. My sense of salvation does not leave anyone out. Although in some moments I wouldn't mind considering. Overall, it does not satisfy my heart. I don't want anyone to be wrong. I don't want anyone to be damned. I don't want anything left out of perfection. It doesn't seem right to me. It just doesn't seem right, you know? Because I look in here, I can find all the crap I see out here. How about you? And I can still see something worth saving in here. How about you? So there is dissatisfactoriness. It is caused, it has an end, and there's something you can do. That's not bad. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Yeah. In the puja, in the Chinrezig puja, it says, may I the great compassion, may I realize the great compassion that steers the pit of samsara.
That is inseparable from the activity. That the great compassion, that is the activity that stirs the pit. All of the activity, all of the stirring of the pit of samsara, of suffering, all of the activity of dissatisfactoriness and suffering is compassion. That's what it's saying. Yeah.
Because
it makes you think. Because it disturbs your view. Because the answer isn't something that just fits into my little skull and my little life and my little cause and effect. It is beyond self. So something that creates suffering is rubbing into something that thinks that shouldn't happen. So the consciousness has to go for a greater answer. When I have been successful in transforming grief and pain and madness, it has been because I had to find something that was greater than grief or pain or madness. And having found that, I was grateful for the grief because it pushed me to go where I would not have gone. That makes sense, doesn't it? And people who have children, they know this, that you will do for your children what you would never do for yourself. Don't you know that? You wouldn't get up in the middle of the night. You'd find some way to get around it, wouldn't you? But you get up two or three times if there's a stomach ache or something, don't you? If it was up to you, you just take a pill, put the pillow over your head. But there is this child, and there you are.
So suffering motivates.
Suffering motivates. There's enough suffering to ask a good question and enough calm to get an answer.
But it doesn't. That's why you to put more suffering into it.
The unnecessary suffering, you should stop.
Okay.
It's not useful. You know, if you are doing things with your food, clothing, shelter, or medicine that cause pain, stop. If you are doing things with the necessities of your life that cause pain, stop. As soon as possible. If you are doing things with your emotions that create feedback of a big way that causes pain, stop. If you are involving your life in so much activity that you don't have space to enjoy yourself, stop. Those are the unnecessary sufferings. Just stop doing them. And that's covered by, you know, in Loving Kindness Sutra, do as much as one is able. It's such a nice little statement, isn't it? It goes a long way, that statement.
And so the rest of the suffering is like food.
The rest of the suffering you pay attention to. Oh, this is dissatisfactoriness. Oh, this is why it's dissatisfactory. Oh, now it's changing. Oh, there's something I can do about it. The rest of the suffering is work with the Four Noble Truths, work with the Banner of Victory.
Because the light turned yellow.
Right.
And when I stopped, when the car stopped, and then the adrenaline had to stop,
right.
The feeling was unbelievable. It just whomp. The heart was just getting pumping, and then it went whomp.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
I look for them now when it turns yellow. I start slowing down.
Oh, excellent. I am happy for you, for me, and for other people on the street.
I'm happy for me too. It's easier in my heart.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's one way to become enlightened.
First become in yellowed, and then come in red, and then you become enlightened.
I came up on one where the yellow light starts blinking before the green one turns
yellow. Yeah.
So I started slowing down, and I kept coming up on the green light, and it was still green, and I kept saying, well, if I go faster, I get through it.
But it's a whole other indecision, isn't it?
But coming up to the green light, then it turned yellow, and oh, damn, I could have made it through that one. So it was quite a conversation.
Isn't that interesting that they now have a yellow light that warns you about the yellow light?
It hasn't got there yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you for asking me to teach Paticca Samuppada and the eight auspicious symbols. And you notice there's a very beautiful gold light in your hearts. And it spreads through your body, through your arms and legs and head. It pours out through your pores in all directions, above, below, in front, behind, right, left, four quarters. Moves right through this city. Anyone you wish to heal, you just imagine them being healed. Being washed by the gold light. Right through the province, right through all of North America, the Northern Hemisphere, the planet. Where this light touches anyone who is suffering due to ignorance of body, of speech, or of mind, the suffering is just temporarily washed. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share in all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Puja at 10:30? 10:30 tomorrow. Chang Rezi. Bring your realms.